Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Negotiation Podcast. I'm your host, Todd Embley, and on today's show, I sit down with Peter Park, WPIC's latest addition in Melbourne and a recognized expert in Australia's consumer brand sector and the APAC e-commerce landscape. Peter delves into his professional journey, his role at WPIC, and why the firm is an excellent partner for Australian consumer brands, especially in the F&B and health supplement sectors. He shares his insights on the rising trends in these categories and highlights the untapped potential in markets like South Korea and Vietnam, discussing strategies for Australian brands to make impactful entries into these markets. Additionally, Peter spices up the conversation with an intriguing discussion about the whiskey market across APAC. Enjoy.
To talk in absolute terms, I would say that the growth potential in Korea is moderate, but you know, compared to like markets like Southeast Asia, that's reasonable to say it because Korea is a developed economy with I think GDP per capita of like USD 30,000-35,000. I'm not sure, but they're around that. They've got certain discretionary power. They're not looking for a kind of like your stock standard factory items. They're looking now moved on to looking for something that is in health and wellness sector, at least. They're looking for something unique that's got some really cool ingredients that can be customized to their needs. So the brands really have to up their game to enter South Korea.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to the Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Peter, welcome to the Negotiation Podcast.
Thank you for the warm welcome, Todd. Really honored to be here. Negotiation is one of my favorite podcasts, so this is great. Thank you.
Yeah, I like that. You were saying that you've been a listener for quite some time, even before you joined WPIC. And we will get to that role in a bit. But first of all, where in the world are you that we're recording you from today?
Sure. So I'm in Melbourne, which is about 1,000 kilometers from the south of Sydney in Australia. So yeah, like I'm as far from the world as I can be, but it's a pretty nice place. Good weather. Fall's coming. It's season's opposite season. So that's where I am.
Yeah, you can't steal our thunder. I mean, everybody over here is like, our days are getting longer. Weather's getting a little bit warmer here in Canada. You know, we're going to have the time change here in a little bit. And I was like, no, we don't want to go to, you don't get spring. We get spring. You get fall. Yeah, you guys could go into your winter. Listen, why don't you give us a little bit about your professional background first before we dive into your role at WPIC?
Yeah, sure. Look, Todd, I think one of the reasons why I was excited to jump on is because our backgrounds are sort of similar because my first job out of university about 10 years ago was in a VC, working for a small family office. And I did a bunch of, startup and tech investment and a bunch of due diligence. So I was very much in the tech community. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do out of uni. I studied law and finance and I chose a finance path because I thought, oh, working with numbers must be fun and tech might be a great place to start. So the ecosystem was booming. It just sounded like a good timing. The thing is that, Todd, since I was a little kid, it must have been a thing with the Lego or something, but I always liked something tangible, right? Like, sure, the tech is like high margin, it's sexy, it's like going to change the world. But for me, it's like about what's right in front of us, that's something we can touch and feel and buy and sell and trade. And you know, as the e-com boom was happening in the US and around the world about 10 years ago when Shopify came out and everyone's like a drop shipping, I thought, well, like I want to like kind of get into a little bit of that to really interact with the real world. And so I slowly started to pivot my career towards the e-com and did a bunch of financial consulting for a lot of e-com brands in Australia. But so around the time of COVID really came the first proper opportunity to get my toes into the e-commerce as well as the growing alternative protein scene at that time, which was quite buzzing with lots of investments and future potential. So I really took advantage of that and tried to take that brand to China, which is also another opportunity that came up while I was at that scale up. I mean, to cut the long story short, it was a pretty epic failure. I think for a number of reasons, but I think it got to prove that China is not the market that you take lightly. And certainly what it taught me is that many people in Australia, including small, like a small and big business corporate executives, is that they don't have like a comprehensive understanding of the China market. Now, I'm not saying that they don't know what's going on in China, but rather I think you needed to give them a alternative view to on China to what you hear in media here in Australia. So I kind of got to see the both sides of the world in both the business and then also the commercial in both commercial. And the political context, which really gave me a good understanding of, okay, well, this is the mindset that you need to do business in Asia. So my natural next step was to wonder, where do I go from here? And I then did a bit of a year stint working for a private equity-backed health supplement brand out of America. They were expanding aggressively in China. And I was the head of finance, basically heading up a few different, the entire Asian region with offices in China, Japan, and a significant revenue presence in Korea. So again, that was kind of another stage of my career where I got to see how the corporates and big companies do things in Asia and how they think about approaching Asia. So combining both, both ends of the town, I then decided, how can I combine these two? Then really start adding value to the Australian brands who I am passionate about supporting. And I think that's what brings me here today to you, Todd.
You bet. It also brought you to WPIC. Can you tell us a little bit about your role and why you think WPIC is a good partner for Australian consumer brands?
So my role is the special accounts liaison for the state of Victoria. Now, that doesn't mean that I will only deal with the Victorian-based businesses. So Victoria is the state where Melbourne is located in. I will be dealing with practically all the major small and big Australian consumer brands, whether they would be in FMCG, food and beverages, and cosmetics, and a whole lot of other categories. We've already had some good traction in Australia in terms of our client base. And what I would be focusing on is to really be the voice for the brands and their owners and stakeholders so that they can get the timely and accurate view of what's happening in Asia and help them make decisions. To your question about why WPIC is good for the Australian consumer brands, well, first of all, Australia is a small market, we all know who's who, and WPIC, I think, is as far as my knowledge goes, first entrant in or the major player in Australia who can provide a comprehensive end-to-end market entry solutions and operational solutions in Asia. Now, don't get me wrong, there are amazing individuals who've built up some great businesses and clientele over the years doing business in Asia, but I believe that WPIC is the first one in the market that can execute on a scale and size that you haven't imagined in Australia. So I think that alone makes the WPIC a great partner. Obviously, there are a lot more things that WPIC offers, but yeah, that's the pretty much the key point there.
F&B and health supplements, maybe not plant-based meats, but those are you. But they, but probably still your strong suits, because those are your strong suits. Let's talk about trends. What trends are you seeing in these categories across APAC?
So, do you mean the F&B in general?
Correct. F&B and health supplements. You know, yeah, which we've also seen growing quite a bit. And I think we've talked ad nauseum a little bit about how in Southeast Asia and China specifically, we have just seen this massive uptick in getting outside, getting active, getting healthy, whether it's snowboarding, even camping or hiking, you know, a lot of these things. And it's leading to people to start, as we've seen historically in the West, the more that you start to develop your body and look after your health, we all start looking for health supplements, whether it's protein powders or healthier protein supplements and things like this, right? So I'm just asking, in the F&B and health supplements scope, what trends are you seeing in those categories across APAC?
Yeah, okay. No, great question. So, I mean, health supplements have been, you know, very popular in APAC already. It's hard to generalize, I think, because China is kind of its own beast. And then you've got Korea and Japan, whose consumers have a very different preferences. But I guess, and for me, I think China is still very much like a on the learning curve. So maybe I might like not make some general comments there. But I've been very close to health supplement markets in Korea, because that's kind of where some of my past clients were based out of, and I did quite a bit of work. And I think Korea, in a sense, gives a kind of a compact view of what might happen to health supplement markets in across APAC, and that is the saturated market in with a sophisticated consumer base means that you know, the early entrants in key categories of health supplements, like you know, the probiotics, multivitamins, they will start to see the pressure on the growth trajectory, and will start have to get really niche and be creative and premium. And I think a good example of that we have seen in Korea, for example, is the Orthomol, which is a German multivitamin bio company. They kind of like came out of nowhere in the last like 5 to 10 years in Korea. But basically, since their launch in Korea, so for reference, like they provide the multivitamin concentrate with a couple of like pills, vitamin C pills. So like a kind of, they call it dual vial, or like a new way of consuming health supplements, you know, like 1,000% daily intake of the vitamin C, which helps you with the fatigue and energy boost. And, you know, that's something that a lot of office workers and people in Korea, but also Japan and China experience, you know, over like lots of working long hours. So they need the energy boost, and they really leveraged that social trend and grew it from pretty much nothing to about $100 million business in Korea in 4 years. Now, that's an outlier. And but, you know, that's sort of like what it takes to be successful in a developed and sophisticated market like Korea. And I would imagine that China is not far from that. I mean, you've got the scale in China, so it'll probably take some time until it comes to a point of saturation, but I think it's already there. Japan, I think, could probably take a little bit more, because my understanding is that Japanese consumers are like very particular and a little bit different to what Koreans want or Chinese want. They have their own specific needs. So, and certainly from my experience managing some businesses in Japan, it's not very easy. There's no easy answer, I think, in Japan. So that might take a while for them to find that what sort of premium supplement niche that the consumers want there. And obviously, Southeast Asia, I think, is still up and coming, but probably a little bit away, few years away from really getting on this health supplement and wellness trend. Lots of it seem to be focused around the fashion cosmetics.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And a lot of those platforms are kind of better suited to that, too.
Mm.
I've never put a question like this forward to somebody in this way that I'm going to do it for you before. But would it be fair to say there might be four markets in APAC? China, Japan, Korea, Southeast Asia. Is that, am I wrong?
No, I think that's a very fair question. I mean, you know, it's, some might say that Southeast Asia is made up of a different markets and regions, and you can't generalize it. But I think each of those markets seem to have their own rules and regulations. And, you know, by itself, it's kind of like hard to say that the market potential and market size is there for any single brand to justify entry. So maybe it, for convenience sake, like, I think, yeah, it is reasonable to put it in one name. But no, you're absolutely right. I think Korea, Japan are sort of like a mid-sized market that's modest growth. China's still pretty decent growth, but huge market potential still, with the middle class income growing and all the country size developing in size, and, you know, a lot more growth potential, but in much smaller size available in the Southeast Asia.
Yeah, and there are some reasons that I say that. I don't mean to generalize culturally for Southeast Asia, but I think when it regards to e-commerce platforms, social platforms, this is where they typically share the same, or maturity of the consumers and their desires, and maybe similar spending in different demographic categories. They, you know, just in their, you know, like you said, you know, where Korea and Japan could be quite mature in some. You might say that, you know, China is an adolescent, you know, getting to be an adult. APAC would fall somewhere in there as well, just somewhat similarly across them. But, you know, you have WeChat in China, you have Line in Japan, you have Kakao in Korea. And then really the Southeast Asia kind of adopted the West with platforms like Facebook and things, even though their preferred e-commerce platforms is more of the Shopee, Lazada, or even the up and coming TikTok Shop, versus, you know, China has very specific, Korea has very specific, and Japan has very specific. So I think that in that, that's the way I'm kind of putting them in those buckets, if you have anything to say about what I just said.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. They all have their own ecosystems, and Korea kind of developed it their own. You know, there's the Coupang and Naver basically sharing basically duopoly market shares. Whereas in China, that's not the case. There's a lot more competition between the platforms. So it's kind of like their own league there. And they're heavily numbers driven. Whereas I think in Korea, you've still got a chance if you kind of take off with a couple of celebrities or, KOLs like type of people. I think there's still chance to grow your share. But yeah, Southeast Asia, as you said, you're right. They kind of like took that system from China. And, you know, it doesn't kind of like make sense that, you know, for example, Lazada is like owned by Alibaba. So they would have brought a lot of the practices from mainland. But yeah, like I think it would be interesting to see how they develop their own e-commerce ecosystem, because, you know, TikTok's like still pretty getting popular in Southeast Asia. But it's also banned in Indonesia, and like I think it recently banned in Vietnam, right? So it'd be interesting to see like how, say, Shopee takes the remaining share of that, or maybe Lazada comes up with some more innovative, strategies to retake the market share that they've lost over the past few years. So I think there's a lot of interesting developments there.
I want to, like you talked about South Korea being still having a lot of opportunity. I'm going to come to that one second, but you mentioned, you know, TikTok being banned in like Indonesia or potentially Vietnam. Is it TikTok banned? Is it Douyin banned? Or is it both? Do you know?
No, actually, I mean, I'm not sure if it's the Douyin or the TikTok version that they launched in the region.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I might actually have to go and then clarify that because that might be quite different story.
Yeah. And you're going to probably piss off a very different group of people, depending on which one it is.
Yeah. That's
talking
right.
About where. So where do you see the biggest opportunities for Australian brands in the categories of F&B and health supplements?
Yeah, I think that's a good question to come back to. Look, I mean, before I kind of go into that, I might just say a couple of things about, you know, why Australia is like positioned well to take advantage of the APAC growth. And that is that off the back of our strength in the primary industries, such as the agriculture and natural resources, we're known to the Asian consumers as kind of the clean ingredients that come from a pristine environment. So there is almost like an automatic level of a trust and the credentials that Australia is known for. And that's made in Australia, in that sense, has a pretty good marketing leverage already. You are getting ahead of many of the other countries that provide similar products. So I would say that's a one thing. The other thing is that for certain industries and like I say, for example, a sunscreen industry, right? Like we are in the opposite season. So basically we can... while the you know, the northern hemisphere is in winter, we're in summer, so we can sort of like leverage that seasonal difference, but also take advantage of the time zone the difference as well. We're in the same time zone as the Asia Pacific, and I think like that could have a long term impact on our ability, Australian brands' ability to build a better relationship that is with the Asian stakeholders in a very timely manner. And that's kind of like why I'm here, because you know, I want to be in the same time zone as our as the people who buy our services and products.
Agreed. Now, are there any particular product subcategories or markets that are poised for growth?
Okay. So I think health supplements are very well known, and I think it will continue to record a moderate growth. Like now, it's not going to be as explosive as we've seen during China's golden age of growth 10 years ago. But certainly you've got a health supplement brands like Blackmores, Swiss, and LifeSpace having made a good presence in China. And we've got like a good, very high quality TGA, Australian equivalent of FDA approved facilities pumping out these high quality products. So I think there's always, you know, moderate growth potential for people like that. But I think also cosmetics, as you said, right? There's sure, like cosmetics brand like Korean Beauty, for example, China Beauty, Japan Beauty. Yes, they're super creative and they're competitive. But I think what Australia can offer is our ability to source differentiate through a unique ingredients. Like, for example, I have seen an Australian skincare brand launch in Korea, Costco Korea, actually, recently, and then also through the different e-commerce platforms using some chemicals that they extracted from Australian wool. Now, you cannot go and replicate that. That is a you know, our own unique differentiation. And I think like you know, if you can sort of use these ingredients or points of differentiation as well, then there is certainly a niche growth potential for those brands as well.
You've written recently that South Korea is an underrated market. I think you mentioned previously that it's a market that still contains a lot of opportunity. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Tell us why.
Right. Okay. I think, you know, And I, again, like I might be coming from a fairly typical, the views here, but also I've lived in Australia long enough to kind of like understand how people view APAC. And that is that when you mention Asia, like mostly like it's Japan or Southeast Asia, or like Thailand or Bali that comes up on our mind, followed by perhaps China because of this pure sheer size and the political significance they have in our system. But so South Korea kind of pops up every now and then, like, you know, the K beauties are known, like people know Squid Game now. And, you know, Korea's largest conglomerate called CJ launched their the dumpling brand in Australia. So, yeah, it's being known. But I'll say overall, it's not really something that pops up on people's mind. And that's why I sort of call it the underrated, because you know, if you don't have it on your radar, then you don't understand the potential. Therefore, it becomes underrated. Now, to talk in absolute terms, I would say that the growth potential in Korea is moderate, but, you know, compared to like markets like Southeast Asia. And that's reasonable to say it because Korea is a developed economy with, I think, GDP per capita of like USD 35,000. I'm not sure, but they're all around that. So they've got certain discretionary power and they are looking, they're not looking for a kind of like your stock standard factory items. They're looking now moved on to looking for something that is in health and wellness sector, at least. They're looking for something unique that's got some really cool ingredients that can be customized to their needs. So the brands really have to up their game to enter South Korea. But because the standard is high, threshold is high, if you can get through their maze of compliance and consumer needs, then you've kind of like got a bit of a blue ocean to explore as an imported or a foreign brand. And that's why I call it an underrated market. And certainly for most Australian brands, they haven't much considered the Korea as their next market. So yeah, that's how I think about this.
Well, I think navigation of compliance and other things, that's where WPIC comes in. Now, why should Australian brands target Korea specifically?
So I think the way I would kind of like explain it is that, you know, if you're trying to sort of present Korea as its own opportunity, then people would be asking, but why not China or why not this and that? And I think it's important to think that first of all, like it takes 8 hours to Korea by flight, or 8-9 hours compared to say 14 hours to America, North America, and about like at least 24 to 30 hours to Europe, right? So as much as we like our motherland, the United Kingdom, it's too far away, and we gotta build our future here in the APEC. So I think that distance alone is a huge advantage. Now, narrowing down our scope, so then we're in Asia, right? Okay, China. Well, it's just too big. And I don't think that every Australian brand is ready to commit to that scale of investment. And knowing the Australian kind of the business mindset, they're a bit risk averse and conservative. And so, you know, unless like a year, unless you know that they've got the enough, you know, cash stash to go into China, or have a hunt, like a very much a clear willingness to go into the market, then Korea could be like a very good starting point where it's a mid-sized opportunity that is not, you know, as a grand scale as China, but still manageable. And you can still build a portfolio of markets like Korea, like doing a few million dollars. And that alone, like you'd say you do it in Korea, a few mil, Japan, few mil, and Southeast Asia, few mil, you've already got a pretty decent eight-figure revenue stream there for your brand. Then you might then feel more confident to go and attack markets like China. So I think that's one pathway that I would try to explain to the Australian companies. And so far, out of the companies that I've dealt with, they seem to agree with that approach theoretically. And certainly I have seen a couple of brands that have taken that path. So, yeah.
Okay. So then, in your opinion, if you don't mind, what might the market entry plan or platform plan look like?
Right. Okay. So first of all, I've done both market entry route. So both cross-border and the you know, general trade, where you have to go through the all hoops of compliance. My view is that you definitely need to go cross-border if you can find the right partners who can execute and make that happen. Because to be honest, Korean compliance is sort of like the worst part of EU, Japan, and then US combined. It's pretty hard. And I know that because I've taken a couple of brands in the past who took like a 6 to 12 months just to get their products registered before they start selling. Now, how many Australian or even any brands have that level of patience in the current market environment? I'll say very few. So I think, yeah, get something set up cross-border, start selling, build up some traction. I know for a reference, WPIC has a the cross-border warehouse in Weihai, which is in a region that's only like a few hours by ferry from Incheon in Seoul. So basically, like, that's a great logistics setup. And I've always imagined that someone somewhere in Australia would provide something like that. So that is certainly some, you know, a good example of how to do cross-border into Korea. And I would recommend that brands to consider that path if they see the potential in the South Korean market.
I have to ask this next question. It's a little bit off the main track. Why are there so many convenience stores in South Korea?
Oh, I love this question, Todd, because, you know, first, I love kind of understanding the retail insights in Korea, but also strangely enough, every time I post on social media about convenience store, it seems to get the most number of likes. I mean, I know it's a vanity metric, but I was just like, why are people so interested? So I started digging in myself as well. To tell you a little bit of the numbers at the high level, there are over 55,000 convenience stores in Korea, which has the world's highest density of such stores. Now, compare that to Taiwan, which already has like something like 13,000 stores in a tiny island, and they have got the second highest density. Now, Korea's double that. So just think like how compact it is. And I think there's a really a demographic factors behind it is that Korea is such a tiny country compared to countries like Australia, Canada, and US. They've got 50 million people there. So you've got a lot of people to serve in such a tiny area. And so naturally, the foot traffic anywhere, everywhere is pretty intense, relatively speaking. And Koreans are very, they're very opportunistic people. I think whenever they see even a little bit of a business opportunity around the corner and, or they see someone across the street, making a little bit of a bucks, then they'll jump on it. And they'll just keep opening and opening until everyone start to share the pie. Obviously, convenience, that's the demographic factor. But in terms of the actual service quality, I think South Korean convenience store is kind of becoming more of a one-stop shop for all things in life, like a post office, delivery, like a paying the tax bills, like utilities, stopping by for a quick coffee. Now, you know, 7-Eleven and those guys have now got like expensive Italian coffee brewing machines that can pump out a cheap coffee at high quality. And Koreans love coffee, right? Like that's kind of another topic. But, you know, convenience stores provide all these essential things that Korean people need in society. And yeah, people just go there. It's massive foot traffic.
Switching countries, Vietnam. Why is Vietnam exciting as a growth market?
Look, complete disclaimer. I read up a lot on Vietnam and have talked to a bunch of people in Vietnam. And I certainly know that a lot of Koreans saw business opportunities in Vietnam, and I've seen some successes and failures. But I haven't been to Vietnam, so I'm just going to put it out there as a disclaimer. And my knowledge of Vietnam is rather, I guess, very high level. But what I do know is that, it's a country of 100 million people, GDP growth in high single digit, which is kind of unseen in any of the APAC economies. So straight off the top, you've got some good metrics there. But in terms of, I think, their consumer sector, for example, I think, as we mentioned earlier in the chat, Todd, they are rapidly adopting the e-commerce systems and processes that worked well in China. And they're kind of like, you know, localizing that at their own level. So I think the growth rate there in Vietnam is pretty exciting. Now, because they are sort of developing economy whose consumer preferences are increasingly sophisticated, but at the moment, I think a lot of the focus is on sort of low-valued items that are easily accessible and don't require much compliance, such as fashion, electronics, and maybe some bulk food items and things like that. I believe that category preferences will gradually move towards something akin to South Korea, China, and Japan. And I think that that could happen very quickly because of the growth pace of this market. So pretty exciting.
Yeah. I mean, large population and definitely a tastes and preferences maturity level that is primed for a big stage of growth. Technology wise, I think logistics wise, they're really starting to come into their own, which you know, again, lends, you know, all those markers are starting to point to, hey, this is a place where you may want to get in on the ground floor because it's about to explode due to all those factors that we mentioned. So one final fun topic.
Right.
Whiskey. Ooh. Tell us about the whiskey market across APAC.
Yeah, I heard you like this topic, Todd. So, I'm hoping that I can give you some insights, but
I'm three sheets to the wind already just recording this podcast. So yeah, absolutely.
Right. Okay. Well, I kind of left out some details earlier in the chat that I do some whiskey, I suppose, trading and business developments through friends of mine. I've sold a boutique Scotch whiskey brand in Taiwan, which is actually the world's fourth largest importer of Scotch whiskey. 90% of the market consumes whiskey there. I think the size is about like a 0.6 billion USD or something like that, growing at 7-8%. So pretty high. Compare that to Singapore, which is the third largest importer of Scotch whiskey. And it doesn't surprise me because a lot of the multinational corporate headquarters have moved to Singapore recently, and there are a lot of expats. I'm pretty sure 20 to almost 30% of their population is expats. So lots of whiskey consumption there. Also growing at a very good rate. Last time I checked, it was something around 10%. So pretty good there. China whiskey market, yeah, it's about half a billion right now, but I reckon as the global economy recovers and the consumer spending comes back, that consumer needs will need to be met. And through my contacts, I'm already seeing an increased level of interest in whiskey, starting with some basic stuff, you know, not like a Macallan 12 years old or about Balvenie or, you know, those Edberg and all those specialty more of a well-known wines, but, you know, something like a bulk whiskeys and things like that are those orders in rise in China. So hopefully we'll see some more growth in China there. Maybe last one is the South Korea. So during COVID, South Korean whiskey market grew 40%, but now it's heavily back down because people realized that the price that they purchased whiskey at was very premium. So the market's sort of normalizing and people are kind of being picky and selective about what they drink.
Back to the soju.
Soju. Well, not quite actually, Dodd. The soju is drunk in social environments and they are not eating out. The younger generations are not doing the company dinners and stuff. So they go home and they don't drink soju. They drink a more premium selective liquors like whiskey. So that's kind of where it's heading there.
Yeah. And I would say that baijiu in China is somewhat similar. That is for your work environment, your social settings. Let's be honest. I don't know who in their right mind chooses to go home and enjoy a nice glass of baijiu. Sorry, I still have PTSD from 8 years of doing business in China, and no love lost between me and baijiu. Peter Park, WPIC's new key hire in Melbourne and a thought leader in Australia's consumer brand space. Thank you very much for being on the show and spinning up a web of information of all things F&B and supplements across APAC. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Todd. Great to be on the show and look forward to working with more Australian consumer brands.
All right. For those of you who are watching on the video, the WPIC YouTube channel, don't forget we have the audio only podcast on all your podcast favorite podcast platforms and vice versa. If you're listening to the podcast, you want to see the video version of Peter and I chatting away. Go ahead and check out the WPIC YouTube channel. We would love any reviews, any 5 stars, any subscriptions, hit that like button, all of those things. Frankly, people, it just feeds the algorithm monsters that helps us get more exposure to more people who would love to listen to people like Peter. If you have any feedback, any comments, or any guest recommendations, please feel free to reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co. We read and respond to every single one of those emails, so please do get in touch. But from me and from Peter and from everybody at The Negotiation, thank you very much for listening and or watching, and we will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.